And now it's time for On Our Minds. One of the smartest scientific publications around is the online science salon, edge.org. The founder, John Brockman, throws out big questions, like what scientific idea is ready for retirement. Then he curates answers from some of the world's most brilliant scientists. Surprisingly, Brockman's own background is not in science, but in New York's avant-garde art world. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about how the intellectual landscape has shifted in recent decades.
What had happened in recent years, the playing field of intellectual life shifted. The traditional intellectual has become increasingly marginalized. I would say in the last 10 or 15 years, 50s education in Freud, Marx, modernism is no longer sufficient qualification for a thinking person in today's world.
You need to have more familiarity with the sciences now, it would seem. And to some degree, the scientists have become our modern philosophers.
And that's what they were. I mean, that's who people used to listen to and talk to. But the whole world of intellectual life seemed to have gotten hijacked. That crowd, you would call them the New York intellectuals that coalesced around magazines like Paris Review, Partisan Review, Encounter, etc. They became increasingly reactionary and quite often proudly, even perversely ignorant of the many significant intellectual accomplishments of our time. It's a culture that dismissed science. There was this tradition in England of somebody, literary person, saying this room stinks of mathematics. The literary intellectuals got away with it for a long time. The people in science weren't making an effective case of the implications of their work, and that's changed.
What I find so interesting about what you're saying is, I mean, you're really talking about the importance of the scientist in modern culture and the importance of hearing from scientists and the ability of scientists to communicate with the public. But if you actually look back to your own background, I mean, you got your start in the avant-garde art scene back in the 60s. I mean, you used to hang out with people like Andy Warhol and Robert Rauschenberg, John Cage, you know, extraordinary people.
And at an evening with John Cage that he convened in order to try out his new ideas on a young group of artists, all the discussion was about networks, McLuhan, cybernetics.
So he'd have people over for dinner to spark a conversation.
And they were incredible evenings, and I was very blessed to be involved. But
and you were young. Weren't you in your mid-20s or something like that?
24. I had no science background whatsoever, no interest particularly. And all the conversation was about science. It wasn't about art. Wasn't about music. You know, you have these epiphanies in your life where you see everything new and different, the same thing, you know, becomes miraculous that was dull the day before. And that's how you'd feel when you walked out of one of those evenings after talking to Cage.
What did he do? How did he do that?
He would throw out these bon mots, and they would just lead to really fascinating discussions. One evening, he basically laid out the whole idea of the internet. This is in 1965, before the technology was even invented. The whole idea that it's a network, that there's no A to B, there's a nonlinear relationship, which is called feedback, where the output affects the input and you get these loops. We're always in the loop, and the pattern, the process, is the reality.
But it's fascinating to hear you say that some of these ideas that paved the way for the internet actually came out of the art world. I mean, came out of, you know, John Cage, this avant-garde music composer.
They absolutely came out of the art world. And by the time I got out of the Army and arrived in New York and got heavily into the art world, everybody was talking about cybernetics and everybody was talking about non-linearity. If you looked at a Larry Poon's painting, this was op art, and you moved your head just a fraction of an inch, everything changed. And suddenly you realize that you were the instrument, that you were the art. Same with Lamont Young, who was even more than Cage, I would say the dead center of the avant-garde. Lamont did harmonic tones that he would play in what he called the Theater of Eternal Music. This would take place in a factory building of four or five stories, and you could wander through, you could sit, you could walk. And you soon realized, after just a few minutes, although you could stay there for hours, that every movement, every gesture you made changed the music, and you were the composer, or even better, you were the composition. Hmm. But the key thing is that the artists were highly intelligent, and they were reading science, they were studying science.
Now, going back to that time, in the mid-60s, the late 60s, when you were hanging out with people like John Cage and Andy Warhol, we could mention Marshall McLuhan as well, mm-hmm. did you know that these people were extraordinary, that they would help shape the future?
It's interesting you mention that, because I've never been asked that, and it's something I thought about at the time and I think about a lot. I had the good fortune to realize when I was 25 that my colleagues, that people my own age, were historical figures. I just happened to be in the right spot at the right time. And I decided, wouldn't it be interesting to track what this crowd is doing? Not just this crowd, but the people that I found interesting. And that was based on the idea that the words of the world are the life is the life of the world, and nature isn't something we create as much as something we say. Hmm. A finite number of people have created what you and I would call reality.
There's another idea here that I find extraordinary. I mean, you're really suggesting that a few people, a few extraordinary people who are visionaries, who are creative, can actually change the way we see the world. In other words, reality doesn't sort of just march ahead on its own. There are individuals who turn it in a different way.
And it's a finite number, and you can actually go through history and identify a lot of them. I mean, Jesus Christ had an idea. That was a good one. But a lot of the people in the last few hundred years are scientists, and more scientists are alive than have ever lived before, and that's a huge change. But even within this world of science, you can identify the person that coined the word quark, the person that talked about selfish genes, et cetera. We have new ways of looking at things, and we create tools, and then we mold ourselves through our use of them. We become the tools. So your heart is a pump until it's not a pump. If you said your brain is a computer in 1970, everybody was into the human potential movement, you'd get your head taken off. But by 1975, you were right on the mark. By 1980, it was old-fashioned already. People were talking about neural nets.
Let me talk about what you do with your website, edge.org, which has been called the world's smartest website. I mean, it has this amazing group of scientists and philosophers. And what is it that you're trying to do? Because, I mean, one analogy would be, oh, you've created a magazine to display what these various people are saying. But it's not really that. It's something different, isn't it?
It is. I figured out in the 60s that I could make a living pursuing things that interested me. The point was that if I found somebody whose ideas were interesting, or theater or movies, whatever, if it interested me, there was some kind of market and other people would also be interested. And it wouldn't be everybody. And the Edge website is not for everybody. It's basically having an opportunity to engage with the people that I think are creating the world we're living in on an intellectual level. And then sharing it with a public audience on the site.
Now, a lot of people bemoan the state of public intellectuals today, and they say, well, they're not what they used to be. Is that what you're doing here, is trying to create a forum for public intellectuals, for people who, especially in the sciences, to be able to communicate complex ideas to a broader audience for those who are interested?
No, I'm not interested at all in that. I see it as a conversation. It's allowing the brightest people in different disciplines to present their new ideas. We're not trying to present somebody's golden oldies repackaged for a wide audience. We're trying to replicate what I started in 1980 with the Reality Club. It was before the web, before people were online, where someone would come and present their latest work or try out their latest ideas in front of an interdisciplinary group of peers, people on their own level in different disciplines, with the idea and the foreknowledge that it was New York City, they were going to be challenged. So on any given evening, we'd have 30, 40 people show up either in the living room or most often in the boardroom of the New York Academy of Sciences. And someone like Freeman Dyson would give a talk. And in the room would be Betty Friedan, Ellen Burstyn, Dennis Hopper, Huey P. Newton, Abby Hoffman, poets, artists, writers. It certainly wasn't focused on science at that time. And it became a conversation, and it was often brutal and often exciting. That's what I'm aiming at with Edge. I'm not aiming for the public, quote unquote, because I don't think there is a public out there.
What do you mean you don't think there's a public out there?
In terms of definition of creating audiences, I look at it like a graduate school, and I'm the only student. But you can join in, and you can audit everything, and it's free. It's a gift. I hope you enjoy it.
John Brockman is the founder and curator of the website edge.org. He's just come out with a new anthology called The Universe. Leading scientists explore the origin, mysteries, and future of the cosmos. And to wrap up this hour, we've got some music from the cosmos, a new piece from Italian scientist Domenico Vicinanza. He took 37 years of data sent back from deep space by NASA's Voyager 1 and 2, and he turned it into music. 300,000 individual measurements of cosmic particle data created this.